in the new dispensation. Yeah, I work with him and Mike Sutcliffe in the publishing board. We established municipalities, and they were not as bad as they are today. I don't know what it is. Okay. Welcome, Commissioner, Mr. Kisweta, and congratulations for your appointment. And we hope that you will bring some magic to collect more money in this difficult financial and economic circumstances that we find ourselves in. I'm not sure if the Deputy Minister wants to make some comments before the Commissioner starts with his presentation. The DG has left.
No, thanks. Yeah, I think the overall comments, we made them at the beginning, so we should allow the Commissioner to commence with the presentation.
Commissioner, time now to make a presentation on the AGP.
Thank you, Chair and honourable members. Very happy to spend some quality time with you and share with you, give you an update of what's happening at South African Revenue Service, and obviously within the context of that, also share with you the annual performance plan. I guess saying this is an unusual year is an understatement in many ways, but it is the first year of a new administration. It's also today my 65th day in the role as the SARS Commissioner. It feels a lot longer. It's unusual because at SARS it is not business as usual, given what has broadly been reported in the Nugent report, and I will also share with you my own observations in the first 2 months. Within that context, I will share with you the agreed annual performance plan, as well as just signpost the development of a new five-year strategic plan, because this is also the year where later on we will come to the committee to present that. My presentation outline is to give you just a flavor of my own experience at SARS over the last 2 months since my appointment. I'll share with you very quickly the immediate priorities. I'll share with you some of the observations I've made, and I've made this observation by visiting about 80% of our staff, by engaging with various levels of leadership, and having one-on-ones with several of the senior leadership, as well as engaging with the Nugent Commission report and its recommendations. As I said, I will share with you just signpost, by way of signpost, the five-year strategic plan, as well as the performance priorities for the year in which we find ourselves. Part of the unusuality of this year is that it's also a plan that I inherited largely, and therefore I see, whilst we will remain diligent to execute on that plan, we also will use the five-year window to refine the plan to how we consider the priorities, because the priorities are evolving. So first, our immediate priorities in as far as internal confidence is concerned, because we do recognize that internally the organization has been traumatized. So restoring governance, integrity, and confidence is quite key, and I'll share with you some of that. We are a revenue collection authority, and therefore the need to very quickly arrest the losses and begin to put in place plans that will give us and the committee a higher level of confidence that the work we will do will deliver the best possible outcome the revenue recovery program is within that context. And then also, there's a lot happening. The commissions, in addition to the feedback and the report from the Zondo Commission, there are also the work from other commissions that invariably informs our work. So what were my observations in the first 2 months? As I said, I visited most of our big offices and I've engaged directly with all of our staff. I deliberately went alone so that staff could talk to me freely and that I could listen to them in an unfiltered way. And I have to confirm, as sad as it may be, because unless we understand and confront the reality that we are faced with, we will not be able to address it. So as sad as it may be, I have to share with you that indeed a climate of fear and intimidation has vested in the organization, and along with that, racial tension is palpable. People openly talk about the levels of trauma and hurt, and this is concerning. Because at the end of the day, SARS are its people, not the processes and the policies and the technology that we use. Those are enabling elements, but at the end of the day, the heartbeat, the soul of SARS is in our people. And staff tell me that they are disconnected from leadership. They tell me they don't trust leadership. They tell me, how are you going to be different? Why must we believe you? They also tell me that there's different levels of treatment for leadership as for staff. Are you going to address that? Many staff, and I will talk about this in particular later on again, have been pushed into work that is meaningless. And then there's a growing impatience to see what are we going to do with the report recommendations that came from the commission, the Nugent Commission. And then they are concerned about budget cuts and the extent to which that has affected them. In responding to them, I believe, Chair and honourable members, that it is incumbent on us to show that we truly care, and not to do that actionally, but to build meaningful, deep, and trusting relationships with our people, to demonstrate to them that we take their concerns seriously, we apply our minds earnestly, and that we will demonstrate a response that they will judge. Whether it is authentic and sincere. I am under no illusion, Chair, that as a leader, and along with those who share the leadership burden with me, it is incumbent on us to earn the trust of our people. We cannot demand it. We cannot legislate it. We have to earn it. And therefore, certainly from my perspective, we have to approach this work strategically and transformationally, but we also have to approach it with authenticity. And therefore, we are embarking on a very sustained and systematic program to continually meeting and engaging with staff. I will spend a significant amount of my time to visit our offices, engage with people, because I cannot sit in my office and receive reports and then believe that I understand what's going on in our front line. We need to sit back and reflect very consciously, what culture do we want? Because if the staff tell me that we have a culture of fear and intimidation and distrust, we cannot do our work if that is what is true for them. We have to evangelize the higher purpose, the reason for our existence. And I will share with you today how we see our purpose and that we are single-mindedly committed to that purpose. We want to make sure we are an employer of choice. We want to attract talented people. We want to attract committed South Africans. To feel proud to work for us and to invest into this important work that SARS does. We also want to establish a listening campaign independent of us so that people who are traumatized can feel they can talk without fear, without concern for whether they will somehow compromise themselves or place themselves in a line of fire. So that's my observation of the staff. I also, in working with our leadership, would like to share with you my assessment of the leadership. I'm required to do that in terms of one of the recommendations of the Nugent report. And I have to be frank with you and tell you that We have a lot of work to do to rebuild the leadership team. We have, at the moment, a level of accountability that is not acceptable for us to deliver at the level that is required. Many of the leaders have become transactional with the engagement of staff. Somehow, disciplining staff using the disciplinary code has become almost the most important tool. And when you resort as a leader to using the disciplinary code, you have failed. We have people who have been on suspension for long. We have 600 disciplinary cases that we are reviewing. We have many people that are on suspension. And then something that I want to signpost is, as important as the annual performance plan is, building an organization is significantly more than delivering outcomes. It's about building an institution that is sustainable. And I want to amplify that in the work as we go forward. And I have to conclude that it is the collective leadership that have contributed towards the culture and the climate that staff experience, and therefore it is up to us to address that. I'll share with you one anecdote. About 60 senior leaders in the organization have received this undignified title of being supernumerary. Now, a supernumerary is when there isn't a place for you on the organizational structure, and you're given work that is not clearly defined. I met with almost 60 such leaders. I looked into their eyes. I saw their hurt and their pain, and slowly began to engage with them and ensure that every single one of them are given meaningful work. We have so much work. We cannot afford to have people on the sideline feeling that they're not valued and they are not making a contribution. So in responding to the leadership challenges, in the short term, I have confirmed the acting appointments. We have many acting appointments at the level of chief officer. So to create stability, I chose not to renew it on a three-monthly cycle. I called them in and I said, for stability, I'm extending your appointments until the end of the year, unless something happens sooner. Secondly, we have assigned the meaningful work to the supernumeraries, as I said, and then also engaging on an ongoing basis with leaders at a group level, at functional level, as well as conducting performance reviews. But there is a more strategic piece of work that I want to signpost, and that is to answer the question, what is the role of leadership? What purpose must leadership serve? And what are the competencies, the attributes and skills we require? Who possesses those skills and attributes? And how do we recruit and reconstitute a leadership team that can lead the organization forward? That's a strategic piece of work that that commences in the rest of this year. As far as external stakeholders are concerned, equally, we need to restore governance and integrity and confidence with them. They have begun to tell me, and I've also begun to meet with different interest groups, industry sector groups, and they tell me that they sense a disengagement with us, and we can't afford that. I will talk to you later about our strategic intent to that is really based on an approach, international best practice approach of voluntary compliance. So we've begun to engage with them. I've re-established a very productive and functional relationship with many of our government departments, in particular those with whom we have a very close relationship with, National Treasury. We've met and have regular meetings with our colleagues in Treasury. We have met with the new Minister of Trade and Industry and Economic Development together with the senior team, and we have a program that will ensure that we collaborate very extensively, because if you want to address the integrity of our economy, which starts at the borders but also through the entire value chain, then that working relationship is key. And with Home Affairs, we will talk later on about the Border Management Agency, and together with Treasury, we are engaging with the Minister and the colleagues in Home Affairs. Other government agencies that SARS requires to work with are the investigative authorities, the police, the Auditor General, as well as the National Prosecuting Authority. we are in advanced stage of formalizing a memorandum of understanding with the National Prosecuting Authority, which memorandum of understanding will clarify how we work together to give effect to the point where our mandate joins. And let me explain that. Very often, something which starts as a tax non-compliance or a tax offense may very well end up as a potential criminal prosecution. And therefore, it's important that we work with these agencies and hence the need to clarify that relationship through memoranda of understanding. Obviously, the tax ombudsman is an important factor in our life. We have met with Judge Mwepe and also established a rhythm. He is the one who, his office is the office that gives the taxpayers the assurance that SARS cannot be heavy-handed and aggressive, but that we administer the laws entrusted to us even-handedly, fairly, and professionally. Regulatory bodies are important for us because as a revenue administration, we work with and through tax practitioners, tax preparers, SICA, and SITE and other regulatory bodies. And then, of course, organized labor. We take our relationship with organized labor seriously. They are important. I've met with them. I have more meetings scheduled with them. And I've told them openly, they are not our adversaries. They are our partners. And whilst we may sometimes come at from different angles, we have a common cause, and we commit ourselves to serve that common cause, which is investing in our people in the best possible way. Revenue recovery, that's what our day job is, and therefore I'm setting up a focused revenue recovery program, and I'll share with you later on in summary what we do there, but to ensure that we leave no stone unturned, particularly in this economic climate, to ensure that we do the best possible job in pursuit of the revenue estimate that we have agreed to. The illicit economy troubles us, and therefore that's also a cause of concern and particular focus. All of these will touch back into our program, but I highlight them so that the committee can both have empathy for the work we need to do, but also support where we need to, but most importantly, that you can hold us to account for this work. We hear in the public domain about tobacco and the concerns we have there. Well, I can tell you that there are other sectors that present even greater concerns, the mining and minerals, for example. We're beginning to look at the clothing and textiles industry. We're looking at foundries and how those foundries have actually become flounderies because of the level of abuse that takes place amongst scrap metal dealers. Clearly, surveillance at our ports are important because that's where the integrity of our domestic economy is protected. I will share with you later on the concerns I have around debt and disputed debt, so that we also do that. The focus to consumers, as well as what else we can do to render our compliance program effective within a culture of voluntary compliance. But let me pause for a moment and share with you the Nugent report. I'm sure that honorable members have by now read the report, have absorbed it, and have also seen the recommendations, most of which is incumbent on the SARS commissioner. But in summary, the report concludes and Cabinet endorses its findings that there has been a massive failure in governance and integrity at SARS. The so-called Bain operating model review in the estimation of, in the assessment of the Nugent report and by our own assessment had no solid business case. It deliberately sought to render the organization incapable of fully serving its mandate. And it did that by dismantling the trusted capability. Some of the members may not know, but SARS is part of the OECD, it's part of the Forum of Tax Administrators, part of the World Customs Organization, which relationships we are reinvesting in. And therefore, the work we do follows international best practice. When in 2004, when I was fortunate to be there at my first attempt at being a tax collector, when we established the Large Business Centre, it was because that is how the world, large respected revenue authorities deal with large businesses. When you establish the high net worth unit, it's because they represent significant opportunity but also significant risk. And therefore, dismantling those capacities and capabilities did not serve the best interests of SARS. Other units, likewise. The capacity to deal with the illicit economy, I could spend a half a day just talking about that. Then also the disintermediation of marginalized senior executives and also the exodus of capable and experienced staff has hollowed out a lot of the core capability within us. I shared with you my observations around the decline in employee morale and confidence in leadership, and then the decline in what was previously hard-won public confidence in SARS. I remember a time when SARS was an admired institution, respected and trusted, and certainly we need to get back there. Let me share with you the progress on that. So on the first one, we are working with National Treasury, as Mr. Mamoniak had shared earlier, to prepare a discussion paper to look at how do we strengthen the governance of SARS. In terms of organizational capability, we have re-established some of those capacities, including the Large Business Center, as I have on the screen, creating an interim capability to deal with the illicit economy. We will strengthen that, we will capacitate that, we will retool it, and we will repurpose it towards the work it has to do. In terms of the operating model, I have to share that that's an important but less urgent piece of work for us now, but within the next 12 months, we will certainly engage all our stakeholders to refine and confirm, so that there's no question about the operating model of SARS that have unfortunately come about because of the work done by Bain. On leadership and staffing issues, we have already, as I said to you, commenced an intensive process of engaging with staff. This takes an incredible amount of my time, but it is time worth spent. Our people deserve that. We have begun a process. I've appointed a senior leader within SARS, together with some technical legal help, to review the disciplinary cases that have triggered and some resolved, some unresolved since 2014, because we have good reason to believe that many of those cases did not have a solid basis, but they were really instituted to remove people or to marginalize them from the work that they do. We have addressed the supernumeraries and ensured that they have meaningful work. I spoke about establishing a listening campaign so that people who feel traumatized but who just want to pour their hearts out can go. So very often it's just about knowing that you have been heard, and it has a cathartic effect. And then I've also begun to reach out to individuals who have left to see on a case-by-case basis how many of them we can bring back to bolster our internal capacity and capability. On procurement matters, we have begun to review the significant contracts that has, process has commenced. We have appointed a legal counsel to support us. In many of those cases, particularly the high-profile ones like Bain and Gartner, we are also pursuing that and consider them working with the investigative agencies to consider both civil and criminal cases. You see, honourable members, to just pay back the fees is insignificant. If you look at the collateral damage, if you look at the consequences of SARS in terms of the integrity of the organisation and the trauma that people have been left with, how do you deal with that? If I look into people's eyes and I see the tears in their eyes, no amount of money can compensate for that. And then secondly, the revenue losses that have been suffered is, in my view, treasonous in its impact on South Africa. And so we're working hard to ensure that we can restore confidence. But in the short term, we've also begun to review our governance process around procurement so that we know that when something is procured, it is based on a solid business case, not a fake business case. It is built on from the process of formulating it, from requesting for information right through to procurement, that it is done in a way that is completely beyond reproach. And so you will have noticed in the media, and we've made an announcement ourselves, that I put a pause, for example, on the tobacco RFP that was out in the market. And the reason for that is there were some questions around it. And it's too important for a process like that to be launched when we then spend the rest of our time defending it. And we'd rather do it properly, do it once, and get the impact. Strengthening stakeholder collaboration both internally and externally is important. Last week, I visited the World Customs Organization, of which we are a member, an important member, both on the continent but also in the world. And SARS used to have a significant influencing role at the World Customs Organization. I will rejoin and attend the Forum of Tax Administrations under the OECD and many other international organizations, and particularly will become actively involved in ATAF. ATAF is the administration for tax administration in Africa, so we will become actively involved there. So that's some of the context that I thought is important before I dive into the program. And you will see, honorable members, that whilst the program was prepared, the preparation for it started a year ago, as our parliamentary processes work. But there are many things within the program that needs to be nuanced, that needs to be amplified. We need to make sure we direct resources to, in fact, not pretend that the annual program is still the best explanation or expression of our work, but to ensure that we, in fact, do the work that is necessary to turn around and rebuild SARS. But that is important context to that, as well as signposting the next 5 years. I'm going to start by just clarifying something that you all know, that SARS derives its mandate in law. As an independent organization, once established, acts autonomously without fear, without favor, and without prejudice. And with the examples of the acts that we administer, I leave on the screen there for a moment. You will find reference to this, some of the, whilst we derive our mandate in law, we operate within a reality that is global, that is domestic, and that is internal. And so on pages 10 to 13 in the report that you have, you will see how we depict the external and the organizational factors that impact on SARS. We mentioned on page 13 to 15 specific risks that we have identified and how we seek to mitigate those risks. And those risks are important to mitigate that, and understanding our context is important, because that really then creates with us the internal bias to give effect to our mandate. In the next few slides, I would like to take the honorable members through how we approach the work that delivers our annual performance plan. I start by clarifying the composition of our printed estimate. It's useful to understand where the revenue comes from. There are three influencing factors that ultimately produces the revenue that enables government to build a capable state and to deliver goods and services and provide a social dividend to our people. The 1.422 trillion is made up as follows. The most significant part thereof comes from the economy, business as usual. What that means is if the economy does well, that's more giving. If the economy does not so well, then that's not helpful. But we live within the economy that we have, and it's important that we are plugged into it, but it is what it is. On the far end, we have tax policy, and that looks at other opportunities. Tax, I might add, does not only have its intent to raise revenue, it also has other purposes like protecting local economies, defending the integrity of our economy, shaping behaviors for sustainability and to manage risks within the economy. But then SARS administers these policies and in some respects changes in policies has a revenue implication. You will know the 1% increase in VAT, for example, will have an impact The introduction of the carbon tax will have a small revenue impact, but it has anyway, and fuel increases because of the taxes on fuel. I want to focus on the middle component, because that's the work we do. We administer a set of compliance actions. We administer a compliance program and specific initiatives to ensure that the difference between, so if the economy grows, let's say for argument's sake at 1.7%, or and our revenue is expected to grow at 6.5%, you have to ask, how do you fill that gap? Well, the gap is filled by us understanding the work we do, by us knowing that we don't have 100% compliance. Not all taxpayers do what they need to do, and therefore our work focuses on a set of clear principles which I would like to share with the committee. Whilst we administer the law, our efficacy, though, depends on five things. Firstly, it depends on our technical ability, our know-how, to understand and administer those laws. And we know law is often open to interpretation, so the better we understand the law, the fewer disputes we will have in the long run. So it's not an insignificant tool in our toolbox. But secondly, it's important how we conceptualize compliance, and I would like to share with you today how we think about it. I think it's useful and empowering for the committee members, the honorable members, to know that. Thirdly, we need to be plugged into the economy. Now, today, thankfully, that's a lot easier because of the power of technology, and I'll share with you some of the work we do there and some of the work we intend to do over the next 5 years. And then the fourth important perspective is that we build a respected organization, because SARS in many respects is no different to another business. We employ people, we employ money, we have processes, except our purpose is different. Whereas a business has a purpose of enriching, creating value for customers and then create value for shareholders, our shareholders are in South Africa, okay? Represented by government and the representatives of government. So we are single-mindedly committed to serve South Africa, and therefore building a respected organization is important. And then obviously to build trust in the public domain, but also, and very importantly, to present a credible threat of detection. We also don't live in a fixed world, and therefore it's important that in today's technology-driven world, which is littered with disruptive innovation, legacy business models are being disrupted. We see today the largest provider of taxi services don't own a single car. The largest providers of beds don't own a single hotel. And I can go on and on and on. So we live in a world where value chains are being disrupted. They're being virtualized. They're being decentralized. They're being democratized. In the past, we were concerned about physical goods that come through our border, the ability to detect them. Today, you can sit with a 3D printer in your office. You can get intellectual property via email, and you can print it. How do we even know about that? So you can see that our ability to be plugged into that, to use technology, is increasingly going to be a factor for our success because of the virtualization, decentralization of the world of work. Technology doesn't threaten our people and doesn't threaten jobs. What threatens jobs is remaining behind, becoming irrelevant. And so therefore it's important that we understand how we remain relevant, even how we reskill our people, how we rethink about repatterning our workforce and reconceptualizing our work. So we are not intimidated by that. We believe that we can build the kind of organization that will make us future-proof. But they're not only good people. So cybercrime, tax risk, the proliferation of illicit economies also remain part of the evolving context, that we have to be more dynamic. And often within 1 year, you have to adjust. Whilst you remain constant in your ambition and your goals, the way you achieve there has to be a lot more agile, a lot more dynamic than the static nature of a 5-year plan or a 1-year plan. And then we also are not risk-free. So our risk extends from the exposure to an environment that all businesses, all countries, all institutions find themselves in. And therefore, on page 13 to 15, in our plan, you will see how we think about risks and how we think about mitigating those risks. I now would like to turn to the turnaround that is so desperately needed at SARS. And for me, everything starts with clarity, Chair. The clear understanding of our mandate, the clear understanding of the reason for our existence or our higher purpose, a clear vision of what kind of organization we want to lead at the end of this administration, a clear perception of our strategic understanding of our strategic intent, a clear program of work, and the capability and capacity to execute that. As I said, in many cases, we are like another business, like another operation, except we are clear that we serve a different purpose, and we act in the interest of all South Africans, not in the interest of a sector, a constituency, or a narrow base of shareholders. In other words, we have to think strategy. We have to think operations. We have to think human capital. We have to think return on investment. We have to think business case. All of the things that a business will think about, we have to think, have clarity around that, and ensure that we use the resources made available for us to good effect. We have to be clear about why we exist. And whilst our mandate is collecting revenues, ensuring optimal compliance with tax and customs legislation, and providing a customs service that optimizes revenue, protects our borders well, and facilitates legitimate trade, we exist to serve a higher purpose. And you will not be a happy chappy in SARS if you don't buy into this. You will not be a happy and engaged employee if you don't buy into this. We single-mindedly live by the conviction that SARS exists to enable government to build a capable state that fosters sustainable economic growth and social development that serves the well-being, material, emotional, spiritual, social, psychological well-being of all South Africans. We are single-mindedly resolute to that purpose. We have a vision of what we would like to be by 2024. And when we engage you on our five-year plan, we'll share more on that. But we want to be a smart, modern SARS with unquestionable integrity that is both trusted and admired locally and abroad. We want to, as we were 5, 10 years ago, we want to be a role model for other revenue authorities to come and see how we do things, as we did when we first introduced electronic filing 13, 14 years ago. So this means that we have to aspire to some things. So internally, we aspire to a point where our stakeholders, and this requires professionalism, competence from us, that every stakeholder can be engaged with ethically and beyond reproach. Secondly, that we use technology and data to build an intelligent organization. Thirdly, that we evolve our staffing models to be completely future-proof. We still do too much administrative work that has low value. We need to leverage our work by upskilling ourselves to do high-value knowledge work and service work. And then we want to become an employer of choice. We would like many, many more South Africans who are competent to feel that this is where they would like to work. Externally, we aspire to achieve our strategic intent of voluntary compliance, and I'll come back to share a little bit more about that. We want to benchmark against the best in the world. We want to regain public trust and confidence without any hesitation, with any doubt. And we want to provide the financial resources for government to deliver the much-needed social programs. And you can see that set out on page 6 of the plan that we have given you. What is our intent? Our strategic intent is to develop a tax and customs system of voluntary compliance and, where appropriate, enforced responsibly and decisively. Why voluntary compliance? On the next page of the slide, I share with you a glossary of terms, because you will hear us use these terms whenever we engage with you. This is also on page 3, so that you have a permanent record of this. Voluntary compliance is necessary because it is a culture of high tax morality, where every taxpayer who ought to be registered is registered, who ought to declare honestly and on time, who ought to make a payment, make the payment that is due when it is due. And we need to do this in the way that requires the least cost on society. Cost to the taxpayer, cost to SARS, but also cost to South Africa. And that's why voluntary compliance is the highest leverage approach to managing a revenue authority, because it means that the ecosystem works with us to deliver the result that we need. Compliance theory means, what is our thesis about the world out there? How do we think about our theory of the world out there? And I'll tell you how we think about that world in a moment. Then based on that, we have an approach that then really tells us how we allocate resources, how we organize internally, and how we create a program of work. That's in our model, and our program, compliance program, then depicts that work. But you should hold us accountable for seeing it filled with a golden thread through those five terms, because we are explaining and telling you that this is how we approach the work we do. And I would like to empower the committee to hold us accountable for doing this work, which is why I'm taking the time to explain it. So what is our theory of compliance? What do we think of the world out there? Well, actually, we believe that most taxpayers are honest and simply want to fulfill their obligation with the least amount of effort, the least amount of frustration, and the lowest cost to them. Now, let me explain why that is important. If we believed differently, so for example, if we believed that most taxpayers were dishonest and were trying to cheat us, we wouldn't build a revenue administration, we would build a police force, because we believe that there are criminals out there who must be hunted. Right? We'll build bigger enforcement capabilities. But we do not believe that. We believe that most South Africans are honest people. Most South Africans want to fulfill their civil duty. And because that is our theory of compliance, it results in a model of compliance that says at the base of the pyramid, where most people sit, if we make them aware of the obligation, and if we make it easy for them to fulfill that obligation, we will get the result of voluntary compliance. On the left-hand side of that graph, you see from the lowest level, willing compliance, to the highest level of conscious non-compliance. In the middle sometimes is just negligence. Then you have aggressive tax planning. And then you have criminal evasion. On the right-hand side is our approach to that. So at the lowest level, we say we'll make it easy for you to comply. At the highest level, we say we will make it difficult for you to get away, and in fact we will enforce the law and recover the monies and prosecute where necessary. So at the peak of the pyramid we enforce, but at the bottom of the pyramid. And so what we really should be doing is demonstrate in the way we work that we deploy resources, time and effort towards making our taxpayers aware and creating the service that they need, if that is what we believe. And you'll find that on page 12 of the book. We have to understand people's behavior. And so, again, international research has shown us that voluntary compliance is best achieved when we make it easy for taxpayers to comply, when we provide clarity and certainty. In other words, we don't try and catch people out. We try and empower and enable them. Thirdly, we must ensure that there's a credible threat of detection. It's very important that taxpayers know and feel they won't get away with it. Then we have to base our actions on individual cases. No two taxpayers are the same. And so if we treated everyone the same, then the honest taxpayers will be disenchanted with us, and the dishonest taxpayers will be equally feel that they will get away with it. So how we treat people has to be segmented according to the profile, the risk, the opportunity that we, and then we customize our engagement to them. We have to be transparent. We don't work cloak and dagger. We don't work in the dark. Our work is public. It's transparent. And therefore, the more we communicate how we work, how we see risks, how we react where we see risks, the more we contribute to this voluntary compliance. And then how we decisively act when there's non-compliance. And I want to amplify this point, because often people tell me, well, you're only responsible for collecting taxes, you're not responsible for spending the money. Well, I need to share with you, honorable members, that in fact how money is spent matters to us. Because when taxpayers believe that their money is not well spent, when they believe that their money is used for corrupt purposes, when they believe that they're not getting the value for that money, they then begin to feel morally justified to withhold their taxes. And that then impacts on the voluntary compliance culture and therefore impact on the work we do. So we need to communicate unequivocally to public office bearers, to municipal managers, to ministers and director general, that how they spend the money either makes our work easier or harder. And you'll find our compliance model again on page 12. And so in delivering that strategic intent, we have to do a few things. Firstly, we have to we have identified 9 objectives. Clarity and certainty, make it easy for taxpayers to comply and fulfill the obligations, make it hard and costly for taxpayers who do not comply. Fourthly, so the first 3 is our core business, according to our model. The next 4 is the capability we need to deliver our core business, developing a high-performance team that is agile, future-proofed, using the data that we have, using it smartly, deriving insights to improve outcomes, to create more certainty, and to detect risks better. Using technology is important for us because that's how we modernize and streamline our work to present both the service to taxpayers, but also the way we administer it. And then, of course, to make sure we can account for every rand that is given to us in terms of quality outcomes and performance excellence. Then we also need to work within a climate of voluntary compliance with stakeholders to improve the entire system. And lastly, an outcome of our work, which is a strategic objective, is to build public trust and confidence in the tax administration system. More detail on that, the committee members can turn to pages 22 to 29 in the booklet. This is just a visual depiction of what I just shared with you. So you'll see on the left-hand side, there are different segments, because we don't treat all segments the same. Salaried workers represent different opportunities and different risks to high net worth individuals. Small companies, bigger and different risks and opportunities than large companies. Restricted individuals is important for us. The illicit economy requires a different approach. So segmenting our tax base is important, but the work we do is the same for all of them, but particularized and sharpened to take account of the opportunity and the risks and the particularity of that particular sector. And I've given some examples of that work in clarity. It is outreach work, it is awareness work, it is the publications, it is providing certainty through advanced rulings or interpretations, and it is the legal policy and tax products that we produce. Under service, it is registration, it is helping people with filing, and if you've listened to our filing season messages, you would have seen the attempts we do to enhance that. And then the enforcement is about profiling and selecting cases appropriately. It's about the audit and investigative work we do. It's about how we resolve disputes and how we collect the monies that are due, particularly those monies that are in dispute. If we do all of that well, then you should be able to hold us accountable for the following outcomes: for an improvement in voluntary compliance, for closing the tax gap, for facilitating trade and to ensure that we make our contribution towards protection of our borders, for the total revenue that is ultimately delivered, but also for the compliance, the result, the middle block that I showed you. How much are we delivering because of the work we do? And then hold us accountable for the money you give us in terms of both the running expenses but also the capital expenses. And I speak to A as the production work, the what I normally call the eggs that we lay, and then production capability is the goose that lays the egg. So it's important that we ensure that the goose is healthy. Otherwise, if you destroy the goose and produce all the eggs in one year, next year you'll have no eggs. And so we talk about production capability, which is about talent, it's about modernizing our systems, it's about tax policy, and all the things that make for an organization with integrity. And I'm sure that that pictorial view helps you bring together how we see the work that we do. And that then translates into our programs. which you can see on page 22 to 29. I just unpacked that a little bit. I'm not going to go into detail here because the detail is in the pack, but just to share with you a little bit of flavor of what sits under each of those, under awareness, under service, and under enforcement. And we can come back to that if the committee will find value in it. Human capital I single out because, as I said, that's ultimately SARS. Everything else stays there at night. The human capital goes home, and we institutionalize that naturally. So the first three is the core work that we do to deliver the results, and these four represent the institutional capability we must hold to ensure that we are able to give effect to our mandate. I want to close the presentation, honourable members, by just distilling a number of focus projects which will nestle itself within the programs, but I bring it together so that you can see what are the specific outcomes that those streams of work must produce. The first is a very focused piece of work around the tax gap and the revenue recovery. You will know of the work that was done by the Davis Commission. We are re-energizing that work, but also looking at operationalizing it. Secondly, re-engaging our employees is going to be hard and long, but it will be the best investment of our time and effort. We have to respond to the commissions. I've given you a sense of how we already are doing that, and that I created a capability in the Office of the Commissioner that focuses on that. Re-engaging with the public is a multi-pronged approach, but we are clearly and seriously pursuing that. Filing season, if you've been listening to the news, you will know that, but I'm happy to answer any questions on that. Debt management is a very important piece of work that I can come back and talk to. But just to give you a sense, you will have seen that there's a significant amount of debt that is reported of $174 billion, of which $38.5 billion is disputed, and the other $135 is undisputed. Most of that debt will sit in the first, or half of that debt about, sits in the the 0 to 6 months. So $22 billion of debt is within 3 months, and 4 to 6 months. Then $23 billion of that debt sits older than a year, but less than 2 years. And then $25 billion of debt is older than 60 months. The theory of debt collection and debt recovery is important. Even in undisputed debt, there are two factors that are important. We know from the experience and the behavioral insights that even though a debt is not disputed, it may not be collectible. And so the older debt becomes, the harder it is to collect. But also, there is the temptation of businesses to then fund their operations with money that is actually tax money. Now, while the law allows for debt repayment plans, it has to happen within a strict governance process. We can't just cut a deal on the side. It has to be transparent. We have to follow the law. And I think in the future we will report to you regularly on how we are managing that. That's why I want to amplify it. Significant tax disputes are important. I said to you that there's $38.5 billion under dispute. And so it is also our intention to give a focused work around that. The illicit economy, we've begun to address that very seriously. And here it's important that we work with the Minister of the Department of Trade, Industry and Economic Development so that we can be plugged into the entire value chain and not just at the ports of entry and exit. But to give you an example, we find examples of taxpayers who overinflate and misinform us about the nature of exports because that then creates an opportunity for them to claim VAT refund because you are not charged for VAT on goods that is not for local consumption. When you export goods, so there's an incentive to overstate your exports, both in value and nature, because that then is, it's VAT fraud, it's a crime. And we see evidence of that. When you import, the incentive is to under-disclose the value because that minimizes the customs duty that we can collect. So there's an opportunity both in and out. But if we are just at the port of entry, we will miss it. We won't see it. And so we have to be connected and plugged into the entire value chain to know the operators, understand their business models, so that we can track from source to point of entry or point of exit. Another example we notice, for example, between two countries, because we have access to information exchanges, we have access to what the statement of exports is of country A into our country. And then we see a discrepancy and information asymmetry between what they disclose they've exported to South Africa and what we report that we've imported. So somewhere there's a missing link. Border management, we have a clear stand on this. We are engaging the Minister of Home Affairs and our Minister with Treasury to clarify this soon. And then, as I said to you, a significant piece of work to rebuild leadership and to refine our organizational arrangement so that we can be more effective. I'm going to hand over to my colleague, which I apologize, I didn't introduce him at the beginning, Mr. Johnston Mokumu, who is our Chief Financial Officer. I also have Ms. Janae Kaniachi, who is a SARS veteran of note. I found her there the first time and she's still there, seasoned in the operation. And then Mr. Cindy Auger, who shares her time to do the parliamentary work between the National Treasury and SARS. And there's no other SARS people that I haven't introduced.
Thank you, Commissioner. We continue also to be as prudent and good afternoon to the Chair and the members. We continue to be like other departments. We get apportioned money and we're expected to execute our operations within that money. If you look at the slide, we get apportioned in total around 9.5 billion. That's the budget that SARS gets to collect the 1.4 trillion that you had the Commissioner speak about earlier. And we augment what we get from Treasury with other income, which is money that we get from the Department of Education and Training for administering SDL, as well as Department of Labor for UIF. We act as agents. Therefore, the 312 million that you see on the screen speaks to that collection. We have got internal expenditures that we then incur, currently that number is 10.6 billion. And for this year, we started off with a deficit position, and in line with Section 53.3 of the PFMA, we would have approached the National Treasury to allow us to budget for that deficit, with the hope that in the year we will lower that amount to nil. In the prior year, we had a deficit of 1.5 billion, and we worked that out in the year through a number of initiatives that we initiated, amongst those international travel, domestic travel, cut down on consultancy, reduction on legal fees, or legal consultations. So that allowed us in the year that has just gone to come within that 1.5 billion. I think it's also important that we state that at some point those efficiencies dwindle and you need to look at how the organization is then financed. So that picture in the first year and the outer years shows a deficit position, and we'll continue to try and work to better that situation. I must also state that this brings us to a 0.81% in the current year, 0.81% cost of revenue collection, meaning to collect 100 rand, we cost the state 8.1 cents. And at some point, we benchmark that with the OECD countries, and we see this elsewhere being around 1%, and it starts to worry us when we sit at 0.81, because there are some efficiencies that we lose. I thought I would end there, Commissioner. The key message is that we, like everybody else, are expected to tighten the belt. And as far as we are capable of doing that, we'll continue to do that, and we'll engage with National Treasury on an ongoing basis when it becomes unsustainable. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you very much, Johnson. Ms. Pagliacci, do you want to add anything? Nothing? Chair, maybe just to then say that when I started, I also engaged the CFO and the senior leaders and said cost cutting is just a short-term strategy. And in sometimes you run the risk of just postponing a problem. And so we're working very hard to reconfigure our cost base because that's more sustainable. And hopefully we'll address some of that when we share with you our five-year plan. Chair, you can find more of that on page 17 to page 9. And I rest my case there. And
thanks, Commissioner, and your colleagues for the presentation on the annual performance plan of NAPFA. That's the presentation, honorable members. Questions, comments? Honorable Swart, honorable Paulson, honorable Abraham, honorable Cortana, Honorable E. Lewis, Dr. George, Morolo. You want to leave?
Yes.
Hey, Abuno.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. Excuse my voice, I've got flu. It's finishing me. Commissioner, let me congratulate you on your appointment. We understand that the task at hand is, or the task ahead is daunting. But this country requires leaders of high moral integrity. It's unfortunate that you have been appointed in an environment where there are instances of intimidation and lost of morale. But the fact that you are appointed is indicative of your ability to lead an institution of the magnitude and size of SARS. So we hope that you will continue to distinguish yourself diligently in your new responsibility. Thank you very much. Chairperson, it is public knowledge that young people in South Africa bear more the brunt of poverty, of inequality, of unemployment. Now, a few years ago, tax incentive scheme was introduced to, amongst others, address the high levels of youth unemployment in South Africa. There is now a new criticism that companies who employ young people do so because they would want to acquire tax rebates from government. But under normal circumstances, companies employ young people that they would employ under normal circumstances. Our question is, to what extent is the tax incentive scheme continuing to benefit government? Do you think the objectives for which it was established are realized? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Honorable Morolo. Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair, and also from my side, congratulations. It's good to see you back at SARS after many years. I think it's you know, having gone through the Nugent Commission, and I think it is disgraceful that SARS was allowed to get to this stage. And thank you for being frank with the state of the personnel, where you've engaged with them and found out exactly, and thank you for your attempts to recover. I think what you, when you point out the restoration of the credibility of SARS is very important in the eyes of the public, given the fact that it is self-taxation almost, as you've said. That is, to me, very, very important. The point that I wanted to raise is you indicated the tax shortfall for the previous year, and I think it's with the additional 15 billion, it was 57.4 billion. I think that was previously referred to. There was some press releases earlier about what you foresee it going forward, given the 3.2% contraction in economic growth, and that's obviously going to have an impact, and you would pick up already on your month-by-month revenue collections what it's going to look like, because obviously this will have an impact on revenue projections and the budget. That is basically from my side at this stage. Thank you so much.
On a process point, Chair, before Honourable Poulsen takes the floor, we have a member who needs to leave. I wonder whether the Commissioner shouldn't answer that question to allow him to leave.
You will get the response from members of his party. He's a whip this year. Yeah. Otherwise, somebody will want to make a follow-up. You will get the response, Honourable. You can leave. Talk to Honourable Abdabs. Honourable Poulsen.
Thank you, Chairperson. That was just somewhat amusing, the DA wanting to defend the ANC and cutting on my time. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Commissioner, in the fifth parliament, the EFF made numerous submissions with regards to illicit tax flows and concrete submission to the Davis Tax Commission as well. And we're not just talking about the illicit tobacco economy, but all illicit economy. So I'd like to know, currently within SARS, how many people are dealing with uncovering this illicit economy? Because it's substantial, I would imagine. And also, obviously, you've mentioned information sharing and collaboration with FIC, so... what also with the Reserve Bank, Mendelssohn Energy, GTI, Trade and Industry, that information sharing there with those institutions as well. And then, Commissioner, you said, and I like the focus you have on professionalizing SARS and focusing on the skills we have there. But then I'm also concerned because you are chairperson of Technology Innovation Agency, which resides under the Department of Science and Technology. And just recently, we let go of a very talented person, Barlow Manilow. I'm sorry that I didn't mean to mention his name. Under his leadership, TIA achieved 91% of the APP. They maintained their ISO 9001 accreditation. They had clean audits and had the best results of all the DST entities. And they say that there was an agreement between the board of TIA and Mr. Manilow that his services would be terminated. And yet, Mr. Manilow says something else. As per the chairperson of TIA board, the CEO is operationally and tactically strong, but strategically incompetent. I notice you're very good with words, but I just think somewhere there admires something different. The board in its entirety has lost confidence in the CEO and needs to protect the organization by terminating the relationship with the CEO. The CEO presents an enormous risk to the organization, and the board will be negligent in their duties if they don't act decisively. And we are speaking about a man here who's achieved 91% of its APPs. Clean audits, unqualified clean audits, maintained ISO 9001 accreditation, the best results in the DST entities. So, he's a talented man, and you speak about retaining talent, and yet you let go of a man like that. So, I need to understand why you speak of talent retention, developing skills, and a man like that is let go. But Commissioner, I mean, congratulations for someone coming from Kensington. I know the challenges, I know the era in which you grew up, I know the time in which you grew up. I have an idea of the path you followed in terms of your academic development, and I think that's great. I also know about your friendship with Trevor Manuel. You lived in the same community, you were born in the same community. And I'm not trying to impugn on either one's integrity, but you know, you said you were want to retain or you want to regain the confidence that the public has in SARS, and I think also in the interest of that very public, you also need to be very honest with us, in the sense that were you headhunted for the position? Possibly not, because you are employed there. Were you approached, or did you apply for the position? So, you know, and I'm only saying this because I share, or we share, the fact that you would like to regain the public confidence in SARS. And there is this cloud hanging over you, obviously. And probably through no fault of your own. But I want you to tell us, were you headhunted? If so, by whom? Or did you apply for the position? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. I think the Deputy Minister can best respond to that. I don't think we should put the Commissioner as a spotlight. He didn't appoint himself. So I'll refer the question to the Deputy Minister. The Commissioner will respond to issues that relate to the institution. No, I'm making a ruling. You have asked the question. The employer is here, which is the Minister. So the Minister will respond to how the Commissioner, because the Commissioner is responsible for staff below him, but the Commissioner is appointed through that process, the Minister, the President. So your question is very clear. Well, it is going to be responded to. So you will make a follow-up if you feel that it's not well responded. It's a what? Who can hear you, Honourable Counsel?
The deputy minister is new.
No.
There's nothing like a new and an old minister.
He can't respond to that. He wasn't there.
He's the successor in law.
He wasn't there.
The deputy minister. He's responsible for the department even before 94 now. And
okay. So are we going to send Cyril Ramaphosa to jail for what Jacob Zuma did?
Once you become a minister, you become a successor in law of the department.
I want to hear.
No, I'm posted. No, that's a lot.
No, your reasoning is not sound.
No. I'm making a ruling that question will be responded to by the deputy minister, not by the commissioner.
Thank you very
will respond
much.
To the other questions you raised. But how he got employed and who approached him is something else. Honorable Abrams.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for the ruling as well. There's a risk here of playing the man and not the boy. And I think we have documentation in front of us, and there's been a presentation made. And for that, I wish to thank the Commissioner. Chair, in the previous presentation, I wanted to put it to the Department that for some areas of the APP, and now I'm even more convinced with the presentation of SARS, that we need more time as the portfolio committee to be taken through what has been and what is to be within the department, so that we are not found wanting in terms of other facts. Coming to my question, Honorable Chairperson, I think I also need to commend the SARS Commissioner, because in terms of the Nugent report and its recommendation, I think we can fairly say as the committee that a lot has been done already in terms of the recommendations. The question now is, I think it was in your presentation where you say that there is dwindling in monetary terms in terms of support from other organizations like your education and other departments. If I got that right, I would like to know why there is a dwindle in monetary support. My second question, Chair, is on the significant taxpayers dispute that was mentioned. And one is interested to know what is the definition of that. What do we mean when we say the significant taxpayers dispute? And how much does it cost us? More or less, what has that cost us in the past? What does that amount to in terms of figures? And just lastly, Chair, one is interested to know whether in terms of the priorities set out internally, especially, there is a lot of ground that has been covered. And the fact that it is very clear, Honorable Chairperson, that I don't think the Commissioner is conflicted, because the success of any institution, yes, depends on its leadership. However, the concentration on the workers involved in the institution is commendable, and it's very crucial, so that we know it for a fact that the success of an institution does not depend on one person, but rather the collective in the institution. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Honorable Abrams. Honorable Kosa.
No, thanks. Thank you very much, Chair. We welcome the presentation from SARS. And let me also join other colleagues in congratulating the new commission. I think you can see from the presentation that you have inherited an organization with quite a number of challenges. As we've also, I think, alluded to that. But I think we want to appreciate that you have already started to and take steps in addressing the situation, including the issue of having a listening campaign to address the trauma that is there internally. I think that is part of an open door policy for good leadership. So we must commend you on that. Also must commend you on following the findings of the National Commission. As the National Commission indicates that the Commission reported that since 2014, SARS has experienced a massive failure in governance and integrity. And I think that has resulted in a decline of employee morale and confidence, and subsequent to that a decline in hard-won public confidence. So I think we, as Parliament, we have to support you as the Commissioner and as SARS in general, making sure that you respond to all the findings of the Commission and make sure that all those particular issues are addressed. I've got two questions. The first question, I heard that you are saying you've got disputes that amount to 38.5 billion rand. And that's a huge amount. My question is, why such a huge amount of disputes? Is it because your employees at SARS are not doing diligent work? Or is it because we've got many taxpayers maybe who are trying to escape paying what is due to you? Why are we having such a huge amount of dispute in one tax year, if it's for one tax year or if there's been accumulating, I don't know. But why are we having such a huge amount of dispute? Now the second and last question, I think I've observed now of late that I think SARS is more effective in terms of collecting what is due to them. I think you are more effective in collecting what is due to them. I think it's quite good. I think in the long run, I think it will assist us to address this issue of future. However, I've also had a number of complaints that you seem to be slow in terms of paying returns to taxpayers. It looks like you are only effective in collecting what is due to you, but when you have to give back what is due to taxpayers, it looks like you are very slow. And other people are saying maybe you are trying to create a situation wherein you will appear as if you don't have all those financial challenges, so that you put all this money from your side, even if you know that part of the money does not belong to you, it must be returned back to some of the taxpayers. I think that's just that thing within the society. I just want to understand as to whether is it true that you are slow in terms of paying back returns to taxpayers. If it's true, what is the reason for that?
Thanks, Kosara. I'm going to be Louis.
Thank you, Commissioner. I echo the positive sentiments and the congratulations on your appointment and wish you the very best of luck in a Herculean task ahead. I've got a number of questions, so let me just go through them rapid fire to save time. I'd like you to say a few words about how you see SARS' role in fighting corruption, and I don't just mean corruption inside SARS, of which there obviously is, but I mean corruption in broader society. Now, the Western Cape government has recently committed to all members of the executive undergoing what is colloquially called a lifestyle audit, at least twice in the next five-year term. It looks like the Premier of the Northern Cape, Premier Saul, is going to do the same thing. An extremely positive development for our society and for the fight against corruption. Now, of course, SARS is perfectly positioned to undertake these kind of inquiries into the unexplainable wealth and conspicuous consumption of political leaders. And I wonder whether SARS, whether you could say something about whether SARS is considering such private wealth audits and tax audits for all politically exposed persons, now that we also have a legal definition of what a politically exposed person is, because I think that would be an enormous contributor to the fight against corruption, and I would certainly encourage and support any effort by SARS to implement some form of lifestyle audits in South Africa. Then a large part of the trouble with SARS began around the allegations, counter-allegations. One still struggles to know exactly what is true and what was not true around clandestine and allegedly illegal surveillance. Now, I have read you quoted elsewhere in the media to say that you're not necessarily averse to the idea of setting up a dedicated surveillance unit in the future to assist with enforcement. And I'd like for you to unpack those views slightly more, because it was just an off-the-cuff quote that I read of yours in the media, but it concerned me because that is the role of other law enforcement agencies, the ones that you've listed in your presentation as needing to work with. And I'd be very concerned to see SARS engaging in that kind of work. Then, this is a slightly more conceptual question. Across the economy we've seen, and across our society, we've seen the assault on independent institutions which are essential to the proper functioning of our democracy. And SARS is one of the more painful examples of that, but there are many others, including the National Prosecuting Authority. And the consequences for South Africa have been devastating. Now, it's one thing to fix the leadership of those institutions and to start turning around the internal culture and restoring integrity, all things that you have committed today to doing, and which you have, I'm sure, almost unanimous national support in doing so. But have you given thought to how we can actually firewall those institutions so that they are not susceptible to that capture in the future? And what needs to be done in order to build those firewalls? It might be that we need to bring some legislative changes to protect our institutions from what has happened in the past ever happening again. Maybe we need to relook at the way that the commissioner is appointed to involve perhaps this body and Parliament as a whole, or make public the interview process. Whatever the case is, I'd like your thoughts on how we can firewall SARS from what has happened ever happening again. One very practical question from my previous lifetime in the Trade and Industry Committee. You will know that there's a real problem with the ease of doing business aspects, customs and excise at our ports of entry. Now, the World Bank has repeatedly flagged this as a serious delay. Business repeatedly flagged this as a serious delay. And we've raised it with SARS many times before. Now, the one thing that I think was missing, you have mentioned that in your report, so I'm not saying you've glossed over it, but there's no specific targets in your APP to say we want to reduce waiting time at our ports of entry to X within the next year. And I would actually like to see a specific performance target to say that this is the current average waiting time at our ports of entry, and we would like in accordance with the target of reducing times and making it easier to do business in South Africa, we'd like to reduce that waiting time to the following over the next year. So I'd press you to set a specific target in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. George.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Kiesvetter mentioned that Bain deliberately sought to render the organization incapable. How did he know that it was deliberate? That's my first question. And then I have read that Mr. Kiesewetter is going to be aggressively pursuing Bain and company for contributing to the damage inflicted on SARS. I support this. The chief architect of SARS destruction is Tom Moyani, the former commissioner. Is he being charged criminally, and is he being pursued aggressively, and what is the progress on that? And then finally, my colleague did touch on this. I don't see much in this report about SARS's investigative capacity in this plan. A few years ago, when I was on this committee, there was a lot of noise about the so-called rogue unit that existed at the time to investigate tax non-compliance. The funding of that unit at the time was not very clear. And then obviously the implication was that if there was in fact such a unit and it wasn't clear in terms of how it's been paid for, all of the audited reports of SARS would then have been incorrect, according to how I understand it. So I'd like to get some clarity on whether there has been any investigation on if there was such a unit, how it was funded, and then where was the funding of that unit reflected in the annual financial statements of SARS so that they would not actually be incorrect. And then I would like to know, what is the current status? Does SARS have investigative capacity to address tax non-compliance? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable George. Who is that, Deputy Minister or the Commissioner? Maybe Deputy Minister can start so that it's clear the Commissioner feels that he needs to respond to other questions.
No, thanks, Chair.
Probably including the former Commissioner. I don't think it would be proper for the incumbent to respond to issues of the former Commissioner. It falls under attorney level. Just clarify all those processes of how you got employed and the former commissioner say, clear that, and then we come to specific questions for the commissioner. Thanks, Deputy Minister.
No, first two things. One is the appointment of the commissioner is the prerogative of the president. And secondly, that there is a report which is in our website which details how the process was conducted. Just at high level, and the report is on our website, honorable members can go through it and determine whether there was any fault insofar as the process is concerned. And from where we're sitting and the final decision taken by the president, everything was above board. Yes, the minister recommended a panel to the president, and the panel eventually, in line with the regulations and the criteria set in the advert, made eventually a recommendation to the president on the appointment of the commissioner. So, like I said, the report is quite detailed, and therefore honorable members can go through the report and challenge the report factually and in terms of the law and what is required in terms of the appointment of the commissioner. Because finally, the president was satisfied in terms of the process and the content and the outcome of the recommendations by the panel. And therefore, Chair, we are very confident with confidence in the commissioner, and he's got our support and is beginning to turn around the institution within a very short space of time. And of course, the Nugent Commission report, the Cabinet has said on it and it has accepted its recommendations, and there will be actions taken. And then some of the recommendation, they fall squarely within the powers and the role of the commissioner, and there will be follow-up on some of those recommendations. I think I should leave it there, but just emphasize that the report, it is on our website, and the honorable members can go through it.
George, ask a question in regard to the former commissioner, which I think you are best capable to respond to that. I think it's also in relation to the Nigerian Commission.
Like I said, the recommendations that are entailed there, they will be followed up, and I'm sure in the next meeting we'll give progress on how far we are in terms of implementation of those recommendations.
Thanks, Deputy Minister. Commissioner, can you respond to the other questions raised by members, honourable members?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, all members. For those of you who sincerely wish me well, I thank you. I'm going to need all your prayers. This on any day of the week is a tough job, given the climate and the context in which it is being done makes it just 100 times tougher. So I need all the support I can get, and I value the support I get from you. On the ETI, I will respond to that later, and in fact, I'll ask my colleague, Mr. Makubu, to give you a little bit of the numbers around that, what we collect versus what we expect. Let me just maybe start with Honourable Swartz, your question about revenue forecast. So I guess you refer to the headline on the front page of the Business Day a couple of days ago. So I'm not responsible for headlines. I think that's the job of the editor. So let me explain to you the context and of how we think about it, and also what I think the interview that I granted was vested. I shared with you the slide around how we think about revenue. So first of all, my colleagues inside the organization will tell you that we remain resolutely committed to the revenue estimate that we have been given, and we will die trying. So I would not internally or externally make a forecast of revenue. If we do at any time in the future, as happened in the past, consider it important to adjust the revenue estimate, that will be done through a proper governance process. Until such time, we work hard to do our best to deliver the revenue that we are required to do. And by the way, it's a revenue estimate, it's not a revenue target. We confuse ourselves, and I think South Africa is one of the few countries that talk about revenue targets. It's not a revenue target, it's a revenue estimate. And that estimation is based on a number of things, including what's happening in the economy. And therefore, if those assumptions change, then the estimate has to take account of that. So what did I say to the journalists? I said, the slide I explained, I said, these are the three buckets. The first bucket is public. We've announced a first quarter recession. And so it's going to be so much harder for us to achieve our revenue estimate, and given the internal challenges, which will take months, if not years, to address, makes it even so much harder. And so that's the truth. But certainly we are not, at this stage, making a revenue forecast. What will be on the Treasury website will be the revenue performance year to date, and so that's public knowledge. And after the first quarter, an official update on revenue performance versus the estimate will also be signed off by Treasury and made available to the committee and published. Honourable Paulson, to the work on the illicit economy, If you ask me, I think we can always add more people to it because the work is just so big, so huge. And you're quite correct. It's more than just the tobacco. As I said earlier on, there's the minerals and metals, there's the clothing and textiles, there's the export industries in many sectors and import industries that are troubled. At the moment, we have 54 skilled people that is directed to do that work. They are working currently on 15 projects that links about 800 cases and then 7 specific projects that have to do with initial illicit financial flows. And of the 15 out of the 17 cases are linked to, of the specific projects are linked to about 509 cases. So it's a huge area of work that I believe we need to step up our capability and our capacity and organize ourselves better. As I mentioned in my presentation, that risk has exponentially increased given the virtualization, the decentralization, and the impact of disruptive innovation on value chains and on operating models. I want to ask a legal question, Honourable Chair, and you must guide me, because I'm happy to answer it very frankly. But I want to ask a legal question and maybe pause that for the end. And the legal question is this. We do not discuss confidential employee-employee-related matters publicly. I have signed such an agreement with the CEO of TIA. I am the chair of TIA. I'm in the process of disengaging myself, but at the time of my appointment, we're in a crucial phase, and I thought it would have been irresponsible just to drop the chair and go, even though that's what my heart wants to do. I've promised the new minister also, particularly because it's a new minister, that I will manage an orderly transition to a new chair. But the legal question I want to ask is whether it is permissible for me to openly and frankly discuss the performance conversation that the board had with the CEO. I'm happy to do so. So I'll pause there, I'll come back to that, and at the end of it, I will take guidance from this House as to whether I should do so. But I would need the protection of this House.
Okay, why not? The business that you are discussing here is the APP of SARS and Treasure. The TIA issue, I think you can respond to it in another platform, not here. Otherwise, we'll lose track of what we are doing.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that. Honourable Abrams, I'm not sure the dwindling support comment exactly, but I think the reality is that since 2014, and the Nugent Commission makes reference to it, the internal observations support for example, the relationship between the Commissioner and Treasury is an important relationship, and that's one of the relationships that we needed to reinforce and to strengthen so that it's productive. So it is in that context that I think we realize that the relationship we have with government departments and the relationship we have with government agencies, where there may even be the perception that it is not absolutely based on integrity and in the principle of cooperative governance, we are very, very determined to restore that beyond any reproach. The significant disputes, this touches also to some of the other questions. So, very quickly, when a taxpayer submits a return, they make certain declarations. That declaration is binding. SARS then makes an assessment of that declaration and may either agree with that or may disagree with it. When SARS disagrees with it, there's a formal process that we engage. So we would, for example, say to the taxpayer in writing, we require more information from you. And we are now a lot more specific about that information request. So in the former movement, it just said, please submit supporting documents. We now say, we need this document to try and just also the principle of clarity and certainty. When the taxpayer cooperates with us and supply the information, we're able then to apply that to the declaration. And if we are happy, the matter is closed. If we are not happy, we will revise the assessment. We will say to the taxpayer, based on the information we have and the information you've given us, we come to a different assessment outcome than the taxes you have paid, and therefore we will issue a revised assessment. At the minute we do that, that becomes a legal liability in the favor of the state against the taxpayer. You cannot then make it go away by any arrangement other than following the governance processes. And there's a formal process. If the taxpayer disagrees with our outcome, they must lodge a formal objection. They can't phone us and say, well, can't you change it or can you review it? There's no instrument in our law that provides for an informal or outside of governance review of an assessment outcome. And so we follow that process, and when finally the taxpayer objects and does not want to, we then enter into a discussion to settle it. Section 88 in the income tax allows for the commissioner, in the best interest of the state, to settle a matter between the taxpayer and SARS, but following a very strict governance process. Again, it has to be transparent, it has to be well documented, the Auditor General can review it, and it must stand up to scrutiny, albeit it's a private matter between the taxpayer and SARS, which is why we don't comment on private tax matters. If we cannot conclude through a discussion, if the settlement process is provided for, we then declare a formal dispute and we go to court. And the court rules. And it's outside our hands. We present our case, the taxpayer presents their case. Now that takes time. I mean, just explaining it took a few minutes. So you can imagine in real life how long that takes. And it's a to and fro, and it's for more information, and if it's a collaborative and cooperative taxpayers, even then it becomes tough. And if it's an uncooperative taxpayer, we have to introduce other instruments in law. We have to introduce a warrant, a subpoena. We have to do a search, and in certain instances, a seizure of to protect the interests of the state. We have to go to court. We have to have a confidential and private tax inquiry. So the law provides for other instruments of engagement in the case of a non-compliant taxpayer. To give you a sense of the magnitude, because you also asked that question, and I think one of the other members also asked that. You asked about the refunds. Someone asked about the refunds. In terms of I said that there's 38 billion and a half billion, and I also said that 25 billion of that is older than 5 years. In the first 6 months, it's about 34 billion, and generally, the disputed is 38, and that can carry over years. The undisputed is 135, so there's more undisputed than more that is undisputed, but we challenge with collectability than what is disputed. So 135 undisputed, of which 25 billion is older than 60 months. And the reason it's older is businesses go under liquidation, they're unable to pay, the debt remains. We follow the normal process as a creditor to get the debt. Sometimes we enter into repayment agreements with the taxpayer. Again, the governance process that is very clearly set out in the Taxpayer Administration Act. So all of these processes have to be very, very well documented in the governance processes and subject to our audit processes. The 38.5 billion will consist of various cases of disputes. So it would be maybe in large corporates, it could include issues like transfer pricing or base erosion and profit shifting or very complicated tax structuring to mask income as capital. And don't get me going because I can talk for long around. That's just something that really excites us. In the case of the ordinary taxpayers, it could be a debt repayment agreement, but then they go out of business. So whenever there is debt, it unfortunately remains on the book because it's a legal liability. We can't write off debt without also going through a very structured process. At the time we have to write it off, again we have to follow a governance process before we at the front end though, let me also be transparent about this. The point that raises the debt is a function of the quality of the audit work we do. So if it's poor audit work, you can create debt that should never be debt. And then you start a process. So it's also incumbent on us to make sure that we work hard to improve the quality of our auditors, the skill, the competence, so that the debt that they do create, which then becomes a legal liability, less of that debt is disputed. And I'm not only talking of disputes by people who willfully and sometimes criminally disputes it, I'm talking of other taxpayers who genuinely believe that we have not done a good job at the audit. So that speaks to the debt, and if there's anything more, I'm happy to come back to that. Thank you, Honourable Abrams, for amplifying the point that one person is too insignificant to turn around SARS. I have no delusions of grandeur. I'm just an ordinary person. As Honourable Paulson points out, I'm a township boy. I'm an on-the-ground person. So I need all the help I can get. And there's no other way to solve this than collectively. But thank you for affirming that. Honourable Skosana, why the dispute? I think that's the point you raised. And I think I've covered that, unless you have more questions around that. It's often, as I said, a dispute because mainly because taxpayers disagree with the outcome. And then the way to resolve it is either to enter into a settlement discussion or to go to court.
You can find one taxpayer with a disputed amount of 13 billion rands. So I think it's important to contextualize the fact that if we talk about corporate income tax, it can take one taxpayer to dispute an assessment to the tune of 10 billion rands, specific cases that exist. So if you look at the 38, contextualize it in terms of
how many matters.
Yeah.
And typically the bulk of that will sit with a few large corporates, as opposed to hundreds and hundreds of little debt from small people, from individual taxpayers. The refunds, why are we slow? So the only reasons we will stop a refund from flowing is, one, if we have a very sophisticated risk engine. So when you make a declaration, we have a rich data set that we can compare your declaration with what we know. If there are gaps in that, we will ask for more questions. If everything is through, you should get your... So I'll give you a sense that of the 5.8 million individual taxpayers that submitted their returns last year, 92% of them got their assessment within 24 hours, and most of them would have got their refund within 7 days. If you don't get your refund, it means you're either selected for audit because of the risk that we've picked up, or there's an outstanding return, and I can tell you outstanding returns is a huge problem for us. I can give you some detail on that. Or we suspect fraud. Those are the reasons why we would stop a return, and then we enter into a process. On income tax, our current estimation is that about 50% of our refunds is really refunds under audit. About 8% or so is under criminal investigation, and about 3% is banking details that's outstanding, and we don't pay refunds into a bank account unless we have fecal it and we are confident that it belongs to the taxpayer. And then We also have errant employers. So sometimes we wait for information. So one of the reasons, the way we do is, employers are supposed to submit the income tax certificate, the so-called IRP5 form. They're supposed to submit that to us because that's what we use at the back end. That's why we don't have to ask you for the proof. Most employers do. Last year, we received about 18.5 individual income tax certificates from about 292,000 employers. But there's still a compliance gap. And that then, unfortunately, places a hold on the individual because we can't finalize the assessment. So that's really around the refund book. But in the back of your mind, honorable members may have that there was a publicized incident around that. I can assure you that the message internally to SARS is very clear. We don't fiddle. It's not permissible. It's a dismissible offense. If we break the law, we will not tolerate that. So we are expected, every employee, to professionally and honestly do that. There certainly is no instruction from my office or from us to manipulate refunds in order to inflate the revenue number. To manipulate it either way, by the way. To either let it flow or let it stay. It's not in our interest. Mr. Lewis, Honorable Paul Lewis, SARS's role in fighting corruption is, so yes, we do lifestyle audits. Can we do it better? Can we do more of it? Absolutely. Can we institutionalize how we do it? Absolutely. So it is an area of work that we need to focus on. So being plugged into the economy means that we pick up telltale signs anyway. So we should know more about you than you know about yourself if we do our job well. Whether you're posting you and your proud new car on Facebook, or you make a Twitter feed about some holiday you had overseas, all of that should feed into our data set and flag inconsistencies. You can see where people live. You can see what cars they drive. You can see how many homes they have. And so it's an area of work that we need to focus on. But we absolutely have a role in fighting societal corruption. But I have to clarify, we have no other agenda. We don't have a political agenda. We don't have a business. Our business is not targeting people, whether they're high-profile business people, high-profile political people. Our business starts with whether we believe there's a tax risk. And very often following a tax risk then results in other nefarious activities. Because very often, tax fraud in itself, which is criminal, but also reveals a web of corruption and deceit. So we are absolutely central to fighting corruption in the state. Clandestine surveillance? An absolute no. I mentioned earlier on, in law, we have certain instruments that we can use, like asking for a court order, for a search warrant, or to have a confidential interview. Nothing clandestine. What SARS is permitted to do is to come into a meeting and to ask, I'm going to record this meeting. We can't come in and surreptitiously record the meeting. That would be dishonest and unethical. But I am perfectly entitled to say I'd like to record this meeting. If I need to take photos, I also have to say I'd like to take photos of the following. In fact, I would like to place this under a seizure. Everything we do, nothing we do can be clandestine. Everything we have to do must be above board. And certainly, I can give you the assurance that, as far as I'm concerned, it is not permissible. If any SARS employee is involved in such activity, they would be breaking their oath, they would be breaking the policy, they would be breaking the law. And I'm very clear where I stand on that. The matter on an assault on the independent authorities, I wish I had the answer. Because as long as there are people in a system, there is a weakness. Because people is our biggest risk. It is our most enduring and sustainable competitive advantage, but it's also our biggest risk. One cannot assume that you will always have an angelic commissioner, but you should not always assume that you will have a rogue commissioner either, because either way, you lose the plot. So one of the Nugent Commission recommendation is for Treasury to review how to improve the governance so that at least in respect of the primary leadership, which is the commissioner, there is both the process of appointing such an individual, but also the employment contract of that individual allows for a better accountability engagement, because every one of us must be held accountable. So we have performance contracts, we have agreements, we sign policies, and in my view, the failure is often less evidence of a lack of regulatory structure and more a failure by people to use it. The commissioner's appointment, I think the deputy minister spoke about that. And unless you have more questions, I will move on to your next question. Ease of doing business at the ports of entry. This is a very interesting question that you asked. So SARS has a mandate on the one hand to collect revenue, and that revenue, as I pointed out, at the ports of entry is either customs duties on the way in and VAT refunds on the way out, and the net difference is the revenue we get from customs, and then also excise duties. And there's huge areas and opportunities for fraud there. So what are the instruments in law available to us? When we detect a declaration that is of a risk for us, we in law may not pass the goods. We have to seize it, hold it. Then you're into an engagement with the taxpayer, and very often you rely on the cooperation with the taxpayer. We would have to make sure that we are efficient in our processes, we have enough resources so that there aren't long periods, but there are also examples where we would say to a taxpayer, we need the following information, and it may take a month to provide us with that information. And the reason for that is very, very clear. Once we release the goods, there's no more. We have also, by that release, in law, agreed that there's no concern that we have there. There's no post-release action that we can take. And so there's huge areas of abuse of corporates and traders. And so it's balancing that facilitation of that trade with enforcing the law. Can we do better? Absolutely, we can do better. We still rely too much on physical presence at the borders as opposed to being plugged using areas that we need to focus on is the expertise to do thorough evaluations, the expertise to do better risk profiling and case selection. Because inadvertently, the poorer our case selection is, we work against our compliance outcome. If I stop 10 people and they all are innocent, I start irritating them and I start spreading a message that we are senselessly stopping people. If I stop 10 people and 8 of them were the right people, then I do. So it's a finely balanced and calibrated work. My honest submission to you would be we need to do more knowledge work, more risk work, to do better case selection so that we stop the bad guys but let the good guys go through. There's something in law called an authorized economic operator where we also license certain operators who are credible and with whom we have worked take certain of our functions over, and we need to work harder on that. But there's an example of physical surveillance as opposed to, and the crooks know about it, right? So 10 mules will get on a plane in Sao Paulo, for example. You know what a mule is? Someone who has been co-opted to carry drugs into the country. So the drug lords would recruit 10 mules. They would sacrifice one. In other words, they will somehow alert us to the fact that there's a handsome gentleman from Kensington, spectacles and a blue shirt, means we have good authority that he is carrying drugs. So what do our guys do? They sit there and they wait for the guy with the blue shirt and the spectacles. Meanwhile, 9 other guys go past. Right? Because of physical surveillance. And so that's the area of work where customs modernization is a big investment in the future. On the performance targets, I think we obviously would look at that as well and to say how do we improve and step up at that, but I think I shared to you the background that constrains us and where we need to do work. Honourable George, the Nugent Commission is clear on the intent of Bain. By my own analysis, having been privileged to set up the large business unit in 2004 and having knowledge of the rationale behind it, I can see no logic to have dismantled it. And so the Nugent Commission is clear on their intent, our engagement with Bain, and the fact that they have effectively conceded by paying the money back suggests that there's some level of admission on their part. We just believe that it hasn't gone far enough. The other question on the former commissioner was answered. The investigative work of the road unit, I don't know what a road unit is, to start off with. I know that SARS in law needs the capacity to respond to this phenomenon called illicit economy and illicit trade. I can't tell you that offhand now, but I can certainly answer the question, how much money is in our budget for this year to attend to that? It's well-funded. Its activities are in our plan. So we can pick that up. Chair, unless, and at my age I forget things, unless I have written everything down diligently, I think I've responded to the question.
Maybe Commissioner, for the member that left, ETI is a cash outflow. It's a refund that is claimed. We paid 356 million to date, and that refund, when it goes out, it goes through the normal refunding process. So it is a refund. It gets audited if there is a risk for it that attracts from the risk engine point of view for it to be audited. So it's subject to all the controls that are currently all refunds are exposed to. So we have paid around 156 year to date in ETI refunds. Those refunds get claimed on the back of agreed legislative frameworks, and we check and audit that all the claims that have been made are in line with the requirements. The effectiveness of the scheme, in as far as its intentions, Commissioner, I don't think it's within our mandate to be able to address the effectiveness of the scheme in terms of what it hopes to address. But in as far as how it complies with our tax laws, like any other refund, it's governed by constitution, by legislative provisions. We audit against that to make sure that whatever we refund is proper. And maybe to the member's point, last we reported at the end of the financial year that we had seen an increase in refunds of 22%. And I think that is enough to show that there is a shift in the organization. There's an intelligent organization. The refund is due, we pay it.
Thank you. In terms of our schedule, we are supposed to adjourn it out so that we allow members to go and pick up their stuff at their offices and take the bus that leaves at 18 hours. Beyond that, I will be disadvantaging those buses. I'm not sure whether there is a pending question, Honourable Holtzman, so that the members should be allowed to prepare themselves to take the bus.
Chairperson, I asked a question up front that I wanted a response from either the Commissioner or Doctor, the Minister, the Deputy Minister, about the the commissioner's relationship with former Minister Manuel, and that to set the public at ease that there was no influence. I wanted to know.
No.
The and the chairperson, you can't.
No, I said.
You can't deny me this.
No, I'm not denying you.
You're not here to protect.
No.
I'm doing this for the sake of the public, but...
No, I'm not stopping you. I allowed you in the first instance to ask that question. You asked
and
the
you said
question,
you were going
to... And I gave the minister, the deputy minister, an opportunity to respond. And he responded adequately.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what else do you want. I never stopped you in the first instance. I deliberately allowed you to ask the question, and you said to the public interest. I asked the deputy minister to respond how the new commissioner was appointed and the case of the former commissioner. There was nothing that I suppressed in regard to both the current and the former. And the deputy minister here responded to those questions.
I can't believe that lame response is sufficient for you because it's not for me. But
what you are saying is that you are not satisfied with the deputy minister's report. I don't think there's anything else that you can say. But to go beyond how the government has recruited the new commissioner and ask other personal related questions, I don't know whether it's the domain of this committee. What we can deal with is official processes, how commissioners get appointed. The deputy minister responded. But how the commissioner relate with other people, it will be difficult for this committee to deal with that. If it was a question that you are not satisfied...
I think it's very relevant, Chairperson. We've seen talented skills being disposed of. While the commissioner was chairperson here, he relayed this guy's dismissal himself.
No, Honourable Paulson, let's deal with
No, and then to come here and tell us that he is going to retain skills, that he's going to develop skills, and they need a talented man.
Order.
No.
Can I say the
point? Order. Point of order.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, this is not fair on members of the committee and alternates. You already said it's 1780. The member, if he's so interested in this committee, must have his name 80 seat as an alternate member at the very least. But now he is abusing us.
No.
He cannot sit here and listen to a non-member taking the committee at ransom. We appreciate the fact that you have given him an opportunity as the rules allow. However, the rules allow nobody to call people names. But we appreciate the fact still you had to bear with the member. Now it's past committee time for alternate members and full members. It is not fair.
Okay. Chairperson, before you wrap up, Chairperson, that's a whip that tells me, as an elected public representative, I don't have a right to come here and ask questions, and also wants to tell me what questions I should ask. And also, whoever appears before this committee in terms of what they must answer and what they mustn't answer. This is why the Zuma government went down. This is why you
are
chosen as a minister.
That is not fair.
Wait, we are not talking about Zuma and Wilson. You were allowed to stay in this meeting and participate.
I was allowed?
Yes.
I was allowed?
Yes.
No. I have a right to be here. You don't allow anything.
No.
I think you are confusing.
No. Can you be
honest? Unless you're telling me that you are right to dictate here.
No. Whom are you fighting?
This is a democracy. You told me I was allowed to stay here.
No.
I'm allowed to be here.
Can you?
I was elected to be here.
Can Can you become...
I think you... No, no, you must know what your role is. You don't allow anyone. An elected public representative can attend this committee without your permission.
Okay.
You don't allow anything.
Can you become...
No, no, you need to know what your job is.
No, no,
and how to relate to other public representatives. You don't allow
people. Whom are you fighting? I mean, you are just fighting. I know, we don't understand.
So you tell me you allow me and then you...
No. But I won't allow
apologize.
You...
Apologize.
No, okay, Honorable Paul, then let's...
No, apologize. Don't ask me what
you're let's come to the last item. Honorable members, next week Tuesday at 11 a.m., we are going to have a meeting of the committee to consider and adopt the committee report on the budget vote. Any other announcement? That's the only announcement. Thanks very much, members, for having participated in this meeting. Honorable Deputy Minister, Commissioner, DG, staff of the Treasury and the Commission and the SARS for having honored our invitation and assisted us in our execution of the oversight of the financial sector. And there are follow-up issues that we have requested, like the municipal support, municipal finance improvement program, and the SOE challenges, and how you are assisting in that respect. Those are the issues that we can deal with after the constituency period. But thanks very much for honoring our meeting. Honorable members, the meeting officially...